Okay, so Rhyme Tovim, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you are. Good morning for those in California. Okay, welcome to part two of our series today, the Sanhedrin Dispute of 1539. Just want to make mention tonight the Parsha Shir will be given by Rabbi Mark Glass of Kansas City, Missouri, I guess. Rabbi, and his topic will be the burden of holy clothing. So that's tonight, of course, our regular parsha 8:30. And please God tomorrow my shir on the Siddur at 9:15. And with that, Rav Aviad, Vavakasha, let's hear about Sanhedrin 1539 and maybe 1948 also, I imagine you'll throw in. Okay, Vavakasha.
Yes, Nachum. Rabbi Kelman, are you just mentioning that who the shir is dedicated to? For whom?
Oh, no,
Are you
just
going to mention that?
the whole series. I don't always mention. Yeah, it's on the email. Thank you. I don't know. Okay. Yeah, the whole series is dedicated to the memory of the cats Rona and Nathan Katz, and their neshama should have aliyot. Their yahrzeits were both recently. Their second and the 20th yahrzeit. So should be the memory should be for a blessing. Okay. Thank you, Rav Aviad.
Okay, Bisher. Hi, everyone. Erev Tov. Good evening here from Israel. I'm talking to you here from Alon Shvut in Gush Etzion. And I would like to continue in our series from last week. I'll just do a short recap from last week and pick up from where we left off. Last week, we spoke about how we spoke about the idea of democracy in halakha and whether or not the Torah values can fit and work together with democratic Western values. And towards the end of this year, we mentioned the big question and the big challenge, I would say, whether or not Jewish law can exist together with a secular alternative legal system. If you remember the context that we're given these shiurim, of course, it's to do with the certain events that have been taking place here in Israel the past year. The certain tensions that exist within the Israeli community here regarding the question of judicial system of Israel. And we spoke specifically last week about whether or not we can give a religious value to a court system which does not follow Torah laws. I really spoke about it quite briefly last week, and I just want to go back to it and pick up from there. I said last week, and I'll mention it again, that there's some kind of real gap between the theory here and the practice. What do I mean by that? That if you really try to examine the idea of creating a legal system that's not on Torah values, from a religious perspective, it is very difficult, if almost not impossible. When I say impossible, again, this is a very sensitive topic and there's a lot to talk about, but it's quite difficult to find within Jewish law models that really give a legitimacy to a legal system which is not based on Torah law. However, in practice, the legal system here in Israel is full of Bnei Torah, of Rabbanim, of from people, both as lawyers and judges, professors of law. Many of my friends and colleagues are in the legal system here in Israel, wearing kippot, and they're religious. So it really seems to be an interesting gap between the theoretical discussion about this and the practice of what goes on here in Israel. I'm not going to debate on this too much. I will say, that there are certain models that the Rishonim talk about. I'll just give you an example. There is a concept called Arkaot Shebisuria. Arkaot is the term that describes a legal system that is not Jewish. And Suria, of course, means Syria, outside of Israel at the time. That the Gemara and the Rishonim already recognize that perhaps in situations where we don't have judges that can judge on Torah law, we can create an alternative system which judges on common sense, which uses maybe perhaps other legal systems, imitates them, uses again a lot of initiative, I would say common sense and legal, legal sense, and it try to be able to function as a legal system in situations where there is no Torah law. Can we adopt such a system here in Israel and say that, well, okay, today in Israel we don't have a Torah system, so we can create an alternative system using this phrase, Arkaot of Syria. The Rashba already mentioned this idea, and in modern times, Rabbi said, well, this is only in dire situations. This is only in a situation when there is no other alternative. But to say that milcha tchila, to say that we are going to create a system that's kind of an ideal system is really difficult. What more that if you think about it, by doing that, we are basically arguing that the laws of the Torah, as they come into the laws of Choshen Mishpat, the laws of Baba Metzia, Baba Kama, Baba Batra, all the legal Talmudic discussions and arguments that every Jew brought up in religious schools learns these sugyot, discusses these questions. What we are saying is that these are laws that are just theoretical. They shouldn't be implemented in any practical way. That's a very difficult idea. We know that today, the laws perhaps of building the temple are laws that we learn on a theoretical level, and we hope that one day we will be able to implement them in our lives. And the only laws that today we really learn that are what we say halacha lema'aseh, that are already practical, are maybe kashrut, yichot shabbat, yom tov, yichot tefillah. But if you think about it, monetary law, legal issues could be used today in a practical sense, and by us deciding that they're not going to be part of the system is a religious challenge and a problem. I would like to continue now and discuss as continuing this idea and ask yourself a question. What is exactly the mitzvah to appoint a legal system, which will lead us to the question whether or not there is a religious biblical mitzvah today to appoint a judicial system and to appoint judges and a legal system. So I will say that in this matter, there is a dispute amongst our rabbis, what we call mechloket rishonim. There's a mechloket between the rabbis from over 800, 900 years ago, whether or not there is a biblical mitzvah to be listed in one of the 613, whether or not it's a mitzvah to appoint judges. I will now, if you look on your sword sheet that I am now posting in front of you, you will see that before we read the Rambam, I will tell you that the Rambam is one of those people who think there is a mitzvah. Obviously, I can't bring a source which is that there is no mitzvah because there is no such source, but there's like an empty source here. The Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon, the Bahag, other Rishonim who don't count it as a mitzvah. Question is, why not? Why is the Rambam, we'll soon see that the Rambam does count as a mitzvah, but why were there people that did not count it as a mitzvah? The answer might be, and this is, I think, a profound idea, which I think is really in the heart of our discussion, because perhaps some other rabbis argue that appointing judges is just what we call a hechsher mitzvah. It's just a means to an end. There is no, perhaps, idea of appointing judges, but rather the mitzvah would be to perform justice. The mitzvah would be for the judges to actually judge. That would be the mitzvah. Whether or not appointing judges is a mitzvah of itself seems to be irrelevant, because it's really about what they are doing, not about appointing. So it does actually make sense to argue that there is no mitzvah to appoint a judge, or there's no mitzvah by itself, and therefore it should not be counted as a separate mitzvah. However, the Rambam in Mitzvah 176, in the positive mitzvah, teaches us that we are, and I'm reading now from the Rambam, it's in front of you on the source sheet, we are commanded to appoint judges who will implement the Torah's commandments and compel those who stray from the true path to follow the mitzvot. The Rambam explicitly teaches us that there is a positive mitzvah. Now, at first glance, this is not so simple, because the Rambam in his Shorashim, the Rambam in his introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvot, in which he teaches us his rules, what is counted as a mitzvah and what is not, the Rambam tells us that he does not count mitzvot separately that are just a means for an end. And surely this would be a case. However, once the Rambam does list this as a separate mitzvah, it is clear to us that the Rambam sees an ideal of itself in appointing judges, in appointing a judicial system that will not only, by the way, which will implement the Torah's commandments, but will actually, as he says here, which will be responsible for implementing punishments, will be in charge of law and order. And when if I continue in the Rambam in Hilchot Sanhedrin in front of you, the Rambam again repeats this. It's a positive commandment, mitzvah deoraita, to appoint judges. It's based upon the mitzvah in Sefer Devarim in Parashat Shoftim, which is Shoftim v'Shoterim titen lecha b'chol she'arecha, as he quotes here in Devarim. And the Rambam teaches us that this mitzvah is a mitzvah that only applies in Eretz Yisrael. If you look at the Rambam, Perek Aleph, Halacha Bet, it's on your source sheet. I'm right now reading it. We are obligated to appoint courts in every region and in every city, only in Eretz Yisrael. However, if you read the Rambam carefully, you will notice that the Rambam continues by saying, in the diaspora, by contrast, we are not obligated to appoint courts in every region. But the Rambam doesn't say what we are commanded to do in Chutz Laaretz. Isn't that interesting? The Rambam says, in Eretz Yisrael, we must appoint in regions and in every city. In Chutz Laaretz, however, he says, outside of Israel, we are not obligated to appoint in every region. But we are, let's fill in the gap. But according to the Rambam, we would still be obligated to perhaps appoint courts in the cities. It's very interesting. The Rambam doesn't really write that explicitly. I don't want to go into this right now, but Rav Lichtenstein and others really suggest that the Rambam, there's a word missing perhaps in the Rambam. It seems from the Rambam's words, something doesn't really make sense here, but I think that even without adding the word that some suggest, we can derive from, that the Rambam does believe that there's a mitzvah to appoint judges outside of Israel, but not the same as in Israel. While in Israel, it's every region and every city, in Chutz Laaretz, it might be only in every city and not every region. Why would that be the case? Why would that be such a difference where I point the judges? Rav Lichtenstein and others suggest that according to the Rambam, the mitzvah of appointing judges might be profoundly different between Chutz Laaretz and Eretz Yisrael. Even though, as we just proved, the Rambam still believes there's a mitzvah to appoint judges outside of Israel, the function of judges in Israel is different than judges outside of Israel. While the main function of a judge, as we know it today, might be just to judge in court cases, to rule, to pass judgment on cases that come up to him, that would apply both in Eretz Yisrael and Chutz Laaretz. However, it seems quite clear from the Rambam that the function of a judge is much more than just to do that. Rather, a judge has a responsibility to teach Torah, to be in charge of the educational system, to teach the people the ways of the Torah. And more than that, the purpose of it could very well be that what the Rambam expects from the legal system in Israel being different than Chutz Laaretz is that in Chutz Laaretz, the judges have to function in just to create a situation in which there'll be law and order within Jewish communities. But in Eretz Yisrael, it's about creating an entire legal system, not just solving disputes that might come up within the cities and the towns, but rather the mitzvah is to appoint an entire legal system that the to ensure that the country will be will have a system that can allow a country to function. And that's a very big difference, right? Whether or not it's about a court in a city, in a town, just to function as some kind of making sure that people have a place to go to for their disputes, rather than a system, a legal system that is responsible for an entire country. By the way, this idea, I just want to show you an example that Wolfenstein, in a very beautiful article, makes the same observation regarding the mitzvah of tzedakah. For example, Rav Lichtenstein points out that in the Torah we have two different sources for the mitzvah of charity. While one is a mitzvah that seems to be a mitzvah that makes no difference if you're living in Israel or outside of Israel, there's still a mitzvah to give charity to your fellow Jew. In the Torah, in Parshat, in Sefer Dvarim, the Torah tells us that there's a special mitzvah to give charity as if in Israel. What's the difference? It's not that there's a mitzvah to give charity more in Israel than Chutzlaretz. It's that the mitzvah of charity in Israel is not just about you giving a poor person, but rather the responsibility of a state to create a system of justice in which we would call it maybe something like a socialist kind of idea. I don't want to go into that right now, but the idea of being responsible for the poor of a country that falls on the state and on the government is obviously a very different mitzvah than just a mitzvah that falls on the individual. So perhaps the same goes here. When the Rambam explained that the mitzvah of appointing judges is different in Israel than in Chutzlaretz, perhaps that is exactly what he is saying. I would like to continue now and to ask right now a very simple question. Well, does that mitzvah apply today? Is there a mitzvah, a deraita mitzvah, biblical mitzvah, rabbinical mitzvah to appoint judges even today? And why perhaps would I question if it is still today? Because the mitzvah of appointing judges seemed to be limited to what we call smuchim. Judges who have smicha. Now, the word smicha today is used quite even today, nowadays, which the translation of smicha is ordained. We translate the word smicha as someone who is ordained, given permission to teach today. When rabbis wish to perform as rabbis, they need some kind of license, where we call it smicha, very similar to maybe what doctors would need, some kind of license to be rabbis. And in today's world, we also use the word, the phrase, the term smicha, as the Gemara uses it. However, there's a major difference. The real phrase of smicha, to ordain someone, really we find it in the times of Moshe Rabbeinu, who gave smicha to Yeshua. Yeshua passed it on to his students, and rabbi from rabbi to student ordained the next generation. However, already during the Talmud time, the Gemara teaches us that the ordination, as we know it, the real ordination that was passed on from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe to Yeshua, was stopped. It ended somewhere in the late Talmudic period. The Gemara even teaches us that the Romans fought against the renewal of the smicha. The Romans realized that if they are able to stop this kind of continuation of giving smicha from generation to generation, they might harm and they might be able to stop the tradition of Torah. And that was really their idea. And somewhere in the Talmudic period, the smicha is over, and there are no more rabbis that have real authority to rule. And therefore, when we talk about the mitzvah to appoint judges, it seems that the mitzvah should only apply to people who have real smicha. And really, that is exactly what the Rambam seems to hold, and many other Rishonim hold, that there is no mitzvah nowadays to appoint judges because we don't have smicha. It's fascinating that there is one of the Rishonim, and you have it in front of you, the Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch, who listed his mitzvot parallel to the Rambam, he just the way Sefer HaChinuch brings down his list of 613 is based upon the parsha. He organized them based upon the parsha rather than like the Rambam did in a list. And on Parshat Shoftim, when he talks about the mitzvah to appoint judges, it is quite fascinating that on the same time that he says, and please read with me, and he says, we never set up a Sanhedrin, whether big or small, except with ordained judges. And he means the real ordination, as he explains. And Moshe, our teacher, ordained Yoshua, his student, with his hands, by pressing his hands upon him. As it is written, Sefer Bamidbar, he pressed his hands upon him. And likewise, he ordained the 70 elders that he gathered to himself. And those elders ordained others, and others others, until the end of all those ordained. So the Sefer Chinuch says explicitly that you can only appoint a Sanhedrin based upon people who have a real ordination. You might think that the Sefer Chinuch holds, like many others, that there is no mitzvah, therefore, today to appoint judges. However, it is fascinating that the Sefer Chinuch, at the end of his long explanation of this mitzvah, says, and this is one of the commandments that is incumbent on the community in each and every place. And he says, and we should learn from this, that even though on account of our, galchata'enu, he says, we don't have today smicha, we do not have smicha in our days, each and every congregation in every place should appoint among themselves some of the best of themselves to be power above all of them, to coerce with all the types of coercion, monetary or corporal, for the commandments of the Torah to prevent anything that is disgusting, anything similar to it from them. So the Sefer HaChinuch really teaches us that even nowadays, without smicha, there still is seems to be, according to him, perhaps maybe a biblical mitzvah to appoint judges. The truth is, you can argue whether or not the Sefer HaChinuch is telling us that it's the ruach, it's the spirit of the law that teaches us that even nowadays we should appoint a legal system, even if it's not biblical. I think that's really what he's saying. I don't think Sefer HaChinuch is teaching us that there is a biblical mitzvah nowadays to appoint a legal system. Rather, he's telling us, listen, it is true that we don't have the ideal judges of the past, but from the words of the Torah and from the spirit of the Torah, it is quite clear to us that the Torah is interested in us to appoint a legal system in every generation. And again, questionable what the Chinuch really means. There's a wonderful article of Rabbi Asher Weiss. Rabbi Asher Weiss, who is one of the leading poskim nowadays here in Israel. I'm sure people have heard of him. He's really a very important posek. And so when he addresses this topic, he actually throws a huge chiddush. He quotes some others that hold that it may be a mitzvah derabbanan to appoint judges today, a mitzvah and a rabbinical mitzvah today. He wants to claim that according to his opinion, there's a biblical mitzvah to appoint judges today. He almost comes out like a rishon here. It's quite amazing. He really is very, he has a lot of, I would say, I'm using a polite word. He has a lot of, strength, I think, a lot of koach. In his ability to come out and voice his opinion, he's not shy to voice his opinion. And he, Rabbi Usher Weiss, writes in his article that he believes that perhaps there might be a biblical mitzvah nowadays to appoint a judge, not just a rabbinical one. I think the logic is quite obvious. And perhaps, I'm just suggesting that perhaps Rabbi Usher Weiss, who's living in our generation, who's living in the state of Israel and realizes that it is impossible to imagine that the Torah would not expect us to have a legal system. It's the Torah's will and the Torah's understanding that no state, no country can function without a legal system. And therefore, when the Torah suggests such an idea, even if we don't have those ideal ordained rabbis nowadays, it doesn't take away from the idea of the Torah, Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'kol she'arecha. So to sum it up, there seems to be a machloket rishonim whether or not there is a mitzvah to appoint judges bichlal at all. While the Ramban, and other rishonim hold there is a mitzvah, they still understand that there's a difference between the mitzvah of appointing judges in Israel or outside of Israel, and the question whether or not nowadays is a mitzvah is also a machloket of itself. One last observation I want to make before I talk, I go back to the historical event of 16th century, which is really where I have to get to soon. I want to make one more observation that really ties and connects what we said before. As you know, the Torah, when it commands us to create a legal system, has a hierarchy of courts. The Torah talks about, if you learn Masechet Sanhedrin, the Mishnah, the Talmud, you notice that there's a hierarchy of courts, as there is today in every legal system. We have the most simple court of Beit Din Shlosha, the Beit Din of Three, which, by the way, in some situations, perhaps can also be Beit Din of One. It's not our topic right now. But the minimum number is usually a member of three, and they really can judge. The Mishnah tells us that the first Mishnah in Masechet Sanhedrin teaches us all the legal areas that they can cover. And then the Mishnah teaches us that above them, there's a court of 23. And for example, capital punishments can only be judged by a judge of 20, by a court of 23. However, above the 23, we have a Supreme Court of 71, and the Supreme Court of Am Yisrael is called the Sanhedrin, and they sit in Jerusalem, they sit in Har HaBayit, in the Mekom HaMikdash, and serve as the high court. This idea is a common idea, I would say a common model, common structure in today in most legal, I'll say probably all, I don't know, but I'm assuming, I don't know if there are any lawyers in the crowd or judges, but I assume this is the common model which exists all around the world. However, there's an interesting difference between the high court of the 71 to all other courts. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in one of his Yahrzeit Shiurim, mentions this idea and explains this in quite a beautiful way. I would like to, it's a big topic, but I just would like to explain Rabbi Soloveitchik's idea, which I think is very important. Rabbi Soloveitchik explains that the function of the 71 is divided into two. Just like the 23 and the three judges, also the 71 serve as a court that deals with legal matters, that they rule in legal matters. However, they have another purpose. And their purpose is to represent the Jewish people. The closest thing that we can understand to that idea nowadays perhaps would be the president here in Israel, or even the royal family, which exists in some Western countries today. While we know that the royal family in certain countries today don't have much legal power, they don't govern, but rather they represent the people in different kind of events, which they represent in an official position, so do perhaps the Sanhedrin function as a representation of the Jewish community. How do we see that? I'll show you just one example of this idea, but there are many. I want to show you one example how this comes up. In the Rambam Hinechot Beit HaBechira, the Rambam in the sixth perek teaches us, for example, that one of the areas in which the Sanhedrin are responsible for is, let's say we want to expand the capital of Israel, we want to expand Jerusalem, we want to add to it, to build and expand the courtyards of the temple or the walls of Jerusalem, then for that we need a Sanhedrin. Why? Because By the way, it's funny because I took my students today to the model of the Second Temple model in the Israel Museum. Those who, by the way, those who come to Israel next on their next visit, if you haven't been there to the model of the Second Temple model in the Israel Museum, it's quite fascinating. We had also a tour guide, by the way, just mentioning our one of our tour guides there today in the museum was a Toronto a guy from Toronto who told me he learned Bialik. So it was like it was just, I told him I told him I grew up in Toronto. We spoke about Toronto. But anyway, just you should know that you have people that represent your city, your town here in the in the Hebrew in the Israel Museum. So expanding Yerushalayim, expanding the walls of Yerushalayim has halakhic ramifications, which I'm not going to go into right now. And therefore, the Rambam teaches us if the Sanhedrin desires to add to the city limits of Jerusalem or the temple courtyard, they may. However, if you notice in the next halacha, the Rambam says immediately after this, we may not expand the limits of the old city of Jerusalem or the temple courtyard unless the consent of the king, the prophet, and the Sanhedrin. Wait, so what's going on here? A second ago, you told us that you need the Sanhedrin, right? In Halacha Yud, it says you need the Sanhedrin. And here you're telling me you need the king, the prophet, the Kohen Gadol, Urim Bitumim, and the Sanhedrin. So decide, which one do you need? Explains Rabbi Soloveitchik beautifully that there are two different functions here we see of the Sanhedrin. In Halacha Yud, the Sanhedrin rule are functioning as a court that gives judgment, that rules in the legal matter. However, in Halacha Yud Aleph, they join the king, the prophet, and the Kohen Gadol as representing the Jewish people. You can't add to Yerushalayim without the consent of the people. And how does one do that? By representing the people of Israel. And that is by the king, the prophet, the Sanhedrin. So you see beautifully from this Rambam that the High Court of Israel has responsibilities not only to rule and to pass judgment, but also to represent the Jewish people in different functions. Rabbi Soloveitchik has a whole article about this. It's Kiddush HaChodesh and other areas, which I'm not going to go into right now. I will add one more idea, right? We know that we need a Beis Din to make Rosh Chodesh. And of course, the famous question is, how do we make Rosh Chodesh today? We don't have a Beis Din today. So the idea is that there's a big dispute amongst the Rishonim, the Rambam, how that happens. But it's very possible that the job, the idea of a Beis Din making Rosh Chodesh is because not because they rule, but more because they present the Jewish people. In order to make Rosh Chodesh, we need the Sanhedrin to represent the Jewish people, which therefore, when if you think about it, on Shabbat we have this custom in which we hold the Sefer Torah. Every community, we pick the Sefer Torah up on Shabbat and we announce when Rosh Chodesh is. It could very well be that that custom of holding the Torah is somehow a parallel idea to representing the Jewish people. When we hold the Torah, we represent the Jewish people, and that was the function of the Sanhedrin. It could be that we are trying as if to imitate the function of the Sanhedrin of giving authority to the time to Rosh Chodesh by representing Jewish people, and that may be again one of the functions of the Sanhedrin, not just to rule. So this is a very famous idea, which I don't want to go into too much, but I just wanted to add to that to explain the different functions of a Sanhedrin, of a Beis Din. The next step will be, okay, so after we just concluded that there might be a mitzvah even nowadays to appoint a legal system, according to some, maybe even a biblical obligation, let us ask whether or not it's possible. Okay, so we last week and this week we began the shiur by saying that it's very difficult, obviously, even if it be possible legally to do such a thing, it would be very difficult nowadays in the state of Israel where most of the people do not believe in perhaps in creating a Torah system, and it would be very challenging. How would we do that nowadays would be very challenging. I'm not going to do right now. However, is there a mitzvah today? Is there a mitzvah today? Would maybe make us think that maybe we should try? Maybe we should try to create an alternative system. This idea of creating a legal system by bringing back the original smicha, the original ordination that was annulled during the Talmud time, is a well-known idea that was made famous by the Rambam. The Rambam has a unique original chiddush. It is his idea that he suggests in several places in his writings that he believes that it is possible, even before the coming of the Mashiach, it is possible to bring back the original ordination of Moshe Rabbeinu. And by doing that, we are able to give real authority to rabbis today and give them mamash the authority to rule and to, therefore to make up a Sanhedrin. The ramifications of this are really quite remarkable. These rabbis, if we would be able to do such a thing, would have real authority to interpret Torah, to perhaps make up new decrees, to maybe change kitniyot. I don't know. Everyone's now going to tell me, let's go around the room and everyone's going to suggest what they want to change. You know, it would take us a long time if we do that, but it is really quite, it's quite, incredible, if we would have, if we'd be able to really create a Sanhedrin nowadays. How would that be possible? The Rambam suggests, and here again, we're going to go back to our source sheet. The Rambam suggests the following, and please, I'm going to read, in Rambam Sanhedrin, chapter 4, it appears to me, says the Rambam, and notice please the word, it appears to me. That is the key here. It appears to me. This is a original, unique idea of the Rambam. He's not saying this is the halacha, this is the rule as the Talmud says, but rather it is my idea. It appears to me that if all of the wise men in Eretz Yisrael agreed to appoint judges and convey smicha upon them, the smicha is binding, and these judges may they may rule, they may in cases involving financial penalties and convey smicha upon others. Unbelievable! The Rambam holds that perhaps if all the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael would agree to this, then they can renew the smicha. Ah, he said, if that's really true, if so, why did the rabbis suffer anguish over the institution of smicha? What's so difficult? They should have done it. The answer is because the Jewish people were dispersed, and it is impossible that they could all agree. Then the Rambam says the following, and this is crucial. This is the crucial piece. If by contrast there was a person who had received smicha, a person who had received smicha, he does not require the consent of others. Instead, the Rambam says one person may give others smicha. Now look at this last line, please. The question whether smicha can be renewed requires resolution. Now, I have to tell you that in the English translation, this is already interpretation of what the Rambam says. The Rambam for sure ends the halacha by saying this question. Right, this question, he says, requires resolution. Is not clear from the Rambam. Is he referring to what he just said here in the last halacha that one person is good enough to start smicha, or is the entire question, the entire suggestion of renewing smicha, does that require resolution? That is a key question to the Rambam's idea. Is the Rambam doubting his own idea? Is open here. Now, the Rambam mentions this idea in several places. In his commentary on the Mishnah, he says this idea in a much more stronger way, in a much more in a way that he's really more sure of it. And he tells us that he thinks that it's possible to renew the smicha. He doesn't question it there. Some people say, well, with all due respect, the Rambam wrote his commentary on the Mishnah when he was 20 years old, and the Rambam Mishneh Torah was written when he was a bit older and wiser. Perhaps that really does is a very strong argument. But the rabbis who comment on this Rambam really argue many great disputes whether or not the Rambam really felt that this is a clear idea, or rather the Rambam suggested this.
What is the Hebrew word he uses, which is translated resolution?
V'adavar tzarich hechra.
Hechra.
Tzarich hechra, with hechra.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, what is fascinating is that there were attempts in Jewish history to actually use this idea of the Rambam and implement it. The biggest attempt in Jewish history, the most serious attempt that almost worked, was in the 16th century. In the 16th century, the rabbis of Tzfat, to be precise, in the year 1538, the rabbis of Tzfat gathered and tried to implement this Rambam. The leader of these rabbis was Rav Yaakov Beirav, Mahari Beirav he's called, born in Spain in 1474. And that's very important, the fact that he's born in Spain, as you'll soon see. At a young age, he was already considered to be a big Tamid Chacham at a very young age. And in 1492, together with all the Jewish community of Spain, he was thrown out of Spain, the expulsion of Spain. And like many Jews, he started making his way around the Jewish community, starting in Morocco, Syria, Algeria, Egypt, ending up at the end in Tzfat in Eretz Yisrael in 1524. 1524, he arrives in Tzfat. At that time, Tzfat is a center of Torah, a center of Kabbalah, and Mahari Beirav decides to begin to retrieve the smicha. And he argues, based upon the Rambam, that if we were to gather all the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael together, we would be able to retrieve the smicha and give the rabbis real authority to become rabbis, to be judges. Fascinatingly enough, who is the person that one of the person that received smicha from him is none less than Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, probably one of the most important rabbi poskim in Jewish history. But there are others that are also famous and quite well known who received the smicha. Amongst them, Rav Moshe Alshech, Rav Chaim Vital. These are very well-known rabbis who received the smicha. However, there's one problem. The rabbis of Yerushalayim weren't invited as if to the party. It almost takes you back to Sleeping Beauty here. The rabbis of Yerushalayim were very upset that they were not taken into account. And the great rabbi of Yerushalayim, the Maharbach, Rab Levi ben Chaviv, who was a Torah giant, writes a letter to Mahari Beirav and tells him, with all due respect, the Rambam says that you need all the rabbis, and we do not agree that you should continue this smicha. And at that point, the letters are flying back and forth between Yerushalayim and Tzfat. Now, I know I'm being taped. I have to be very careful here. There's the rabbis argued back and forth, and it's really quite fascinating halachic arguments that they make for and against the different opinions here. And some time ago, some fellow organized all the different letters that went back and forth into one book called Kutras HaSmicha, in which he really brought together all the different arguments for and against. It's a really interesting book. This guy, though, in his introduction, says the following. He says, some academics, can you imagine, have the audacity to claim that the part of the machloket between the rabbis of Tzfat and Yerushalayim are political, and about that there's like a struggle of power between the two cities. Chas v'shalom, he says, who could suggest such an idea that rabbis would have any agendas whatsoever? It's all, of course, l'shem shamayim. So I know I'm being taped, and I'm just, I have to be very careful what I say, but I think that there is a fascinating machloket going on here that for sure goes back to Talmudic sources and the Rambam and Be'emet. It's fascinating. I don't have the time right now to obviously go through all this machloket, but I think it's fair to say that there was also some struggle power between both cities, who would really rule here, and there were probably a certain kind of personal, perhaps also, struggles between both important cities at the time in Israel. The bottom line is, historically, the smicha did not work. Historically, the smicha was we don't have today, obviously, people that are samuch. Let us ask, though, what was the reason that the rabbis of Tzfat really tried to do such a thing? What was their intention? So first of all, I think it's very important to remember the historical context. We are talking about the period after the expulsion of Spain. We are talking about one of the most difficult times in Jewish history. Perhaps till the Holocaust, we do not meet such a tragic time and such a catastrophe that really was felt all over the Jewish world. It really affected people in a terrible way. And perhaps that by coming to Israel, the rabbis felt that we are living now in some kind of messianic period. We are looking forward to the next step. There's always that connection between a catastrophe and hope for redemption. In Jewish history, we see that all the time. We see that between the Chmelnytsky massacre and Shabtai Tzvi. We see that even in our generation, between the Shoah and the establishment of the State of Israel. And we also see that in the 16th century, there is hope within the Jewish community that the terrible times that the Jewish community went through will lead us to messianic times. And there's no doubt that they were hoping to establish some type of process of redemption. And I say that because, and this is one of the most important pieces of what I'm going to say today, it is clear from the prophets, from the Bible, that creating a legal system of judges is part of the Geulah, part of redemption. Va'ashiva shoftayich kavarishuna, says the Navi. The Navi says that one of the processes of Geulah, of redemption, is returning the judges, the legal system to a country. And as such, in Jewish history, whenever there is talk about creating this system, it is many times part of a wider understanding of the times that we're living in. I say that because I'm holding here a book which is very hard to get hold on. It's very hard to get this book. It's called Chidusha Sanhedrin B'Medinateinu HaMechudeshet. This book, written by Rav Maimon. Rav Maimon, you may have heard of him, was the first minister of religion in 1948. You might remember him because he is that rabbi that sits right next to Ben Gurion at the Declaration of the Independence of the State of Israel. He is that voice who makes the Shekhiyanu Bracha right after the declaration. He is a good friend of Ben Gurion. And he's also the rabbi, by the way, who, when he signed his name on the Declaration of Independence, above his name wrote B'siyata Dishmaya, Be'ezrat Hashem, because he wanted to make sure that God's name is mentioned in the Declaration of Independence. Rav Maimon, and this is quite amazing, was a major, major Talmud Chacham. He was really an incredible Talmud Chacham. He was one of the founders of the Mizrahi movement. He was a great Zionist, a great Talmid Chacham. He wrote several books, really an incredible person who was involved in politics and the Talmid Chacham, something that really is not very common. And Rav Maimon, in the 50s, Also, like in the 16th century, is talking seriously about opening a Sanhedrin. He suggests, just like they did in Tzfat in 1538, he suggests that it is time for us to create a Sanhedrin to bring back the smicha. He of course fails. The rabbis, he tried to go to Tveria, and he said the Tveria is the city of the Rambam. He wants to make this conference of rabbis, and it didn't work. So these attempts, by the way, there were other attempts in Jewish history. I have here in front of me a book that has a whole list. There's a book written called Bashiva Shoftai that lists all different attempts in Jewish history. There are a few of them. The most famous one, of course, as I said, is 1538. So besides the spirit of redemption and Geulah, what else was the reason? So here's a fascinating reason that is discussed amongst the rabbis. One of the reasons why they wanted to renew the smicha is based upon a halacha that teaches us that if a person transgresses mitzvot, if a person sins and breaks Jewish law, in some situations, as we know it, a person can receive lashes, right? We today obviously don't give lashes, but in biblical times and according to Talmudic law, one of the punishments of our legal system is giving lashes. There are certain mitzvot lo ta'aseh, certain of the negative mitzvot, are not only punishable by lashes, but they are also punished by karet, which karet is a punishment that is in the hands of God. It's considered to be a really horrible, terrible punishment, which means that we are cut off from we're cut off. Karet means to be cut off. So what does it mean exactly? It's not very clear, but perhaps it means that in God's eyes, it is a really punishment that we are cut off as if from going to the Shemayim, and is considered to be a very severe punishment, again, performed by Kadosh Baruch Hu, by God. If a person, lo aleinu, eats, for example, you know, eating pork is a isur lo ta'aseh, it's a negative mitzvah, which you get lashes. But there are certain isur lo ta'aseh that you also would get a chiyuv karet. For example, you know, walking today up on the Temple Mount per se, where the temple stands today, without being pure, would consider to be a sur karet. The Jews at the time of during the 16th century came up to apparently to the rabbis of Tzfat and told them, you know, we've been living in Spain for the past 100 years under the rule of the Christians, and we were forced to sin. We were forced to, as you all know, already in 1390, we're talking already 14th century, the Jews of Spain were forced to live as what we call the Anusim, crypto Jews. They were forced to, in their homes, perhaps they were able to live quietly, secretly as Jews, but they were forced to convert to Christianity. And because of this coercion, they were obviously performing, they were breaking the Torah laws. And some of those Torah laws that they were breaking were Isurei lo ta'aseh. They were a negative mitzvah that the punishment would be karet. And they wanted to repent. They wanted to do tshuva and remove the isur karet as if that was upon them. Again, this is a very long ongoing topic, which I'm not going to go into all the details right now. But there are strong suggestions in the Rambam and other Rishonim reading the Mishnah that suggest that if a person receives lashes, then the isur karet will be annulled. So the people came to the rabbi and said, "Give us lashes, you know. Beat us up. Give us those lashes. And by doing that, we will be able to be exempt from Isur Karet. However, if you give someone lashes today, you're just beating him up. There is no halachic status to lashes unless it is given by judges that have smicha. Right? So listen to this. This is what's fascinating. One of the reasons that the rabbis of Tzfat had this idea of ordaining rabbis was to establish courts which would give lashes perhaps to those who wish to get receive lashes in order to make them exempt from the Isurei Karet. This again led to a huge rabbinical argument and discussion whether or not it would help or not help. Many argued, who needs lashes? Surely doing tshuva should be good enough. Repentance, we know, is a very important thing in Judaism. Many argued that there's no need to do this for that purpose. So this was one of the main reasons, but not the only reason. I want to end by a really fascinating observation of Professor Jacob Katz. Professor Jacob Katz, those of you who've heard of him, was one of the greatest he was one of the greatest historians of the 20th century. He was a Fulham Jew who was a giant in Jewish history. And I had this chut once when I was a child. I once went to Hebrew University with my father to the library, and my father pointed him out to me. I remember him sitting there, Jacob Katz, sitting in the corner there over his book, studying. He was a very, very, very important scholar. And in one of his articles, he talks about this attempt in 1538 to renew the Sanhedrin, and he says something very, very powerful, and I really think it's quite an amazing idea. He tries to explain that what's really behind the machloket, the dispute between Yerushalayim and Tzfat, he says, is an ongoing dispute in Jewish history, whether or not it is our responsibility to try to attempt to bring redemption to the Jewish people, or should we lay back and wait for the Mashiach and the redemption to come from heaven? He claims that the rabbis of Tzfat were of the opinion that it is in our hands to build the Mikdash, to build the Jewish state, to bring back Sanhedrin. And the rabbis of Yerushalayim were of the opinion it is not for us to be involved in this. When God wishes to bring redemption to the Jewish people, God will send us Eliyahu, God will send us the Mashiach, God will send us all his messengers. When the time comes, it's up to God and his will to do this. And this, if that is true, and I think there's a lot of truth to it, and this is an ongoing machloket, even nowadays, within the Jewish communities, how much responsibility do we have to bring Mashiach, to bring the Geula, or should we just wait for the Mashiach to come? This is an ongoing machloket within the Jewish Orthodox community, even nowadays. That was what I wanted to speak about. And at this point, if anyone has questions or comments, I see Natser. Has his hand up, so we'll give a few. Rabbi Kelman, is that okay? We'll give some time for questions now. Okay, Bakasha.
I was just like to tell you that I met Rabbi Maimon. He was invited to my parents' home in 1948. He was a fantastic guy.
He was. I'm sure he was very witty. He was very sharp. He was a very sharp man. I know some of his stories and jokes. He was a very clever man.
And he wrote a fantastic book on the Vilna Gaon.
Correct. I have it right in back of me here. I have it on the bottom shelf here.
The wonderful Sefer.
Wonderful Sefer. I agree with you. Yes, yes. Rabbi Maimon was a great person. No doubt about it. Thank you for that.
You.
So, Nazar?
Yes, I have a question about what you said about Rabbi Maimon's initiative. Well, in 1948, that was kind of difficult situation, but in 70 years later, and technical abilities to collect all the rabbis' opinions are tremendous. So why that has not been retried or reattempted? And even if there is a need to find out, should the rabbis do it, or should the Mashiach bring it over? That also can be discussed in some kind of ruling going by the majority.
Okay,
could be introduced.
Thank you so much for that question, because that really is really, I think you answered the question. Some people say that when the Rambam said that when all the rabbis of Israel decide together as one to appoint a judge, that they can do it, even before the Mashiach comes, many people cynically, but not, I think, realistically say, Right. When all the rabbis of Israel decide on one thing together, 100% that's the day Mashiach will come. Meaning, some say that the Rambam as if was almost cynical by saying, of course we can do it. Of course, all we need is one simple thing. All the rabbis to agree to one thing. But that's exactly what he's saying. When that day comes, then we'll be in the time of redemption. That will prove, that will be an indication that we are living in biblical, you know, times. It's almost a cynical, kind of thing to say, but I think it's very, unfortunately, I think it's very pragmatic and very realistic approach to this idea. And I thank you for that question, because I think that's exactly what the Rambam may be saying.
Okay, I see Louis just pointing out that, right, we say Chaverim Kol Yisrael, you know, to all come together. You mentioned the Rosh Chodesh connection. But right. I don't know if you show this, of course, this is my little Sefer Chidusha Sanhedrin.
I just showed it,
right. I missed a couple minutes. There you go. So Rav Lichtenstein, the first shiur in my life I ever heard from Rav Lichtenstein was on Sanhedrin. We're learning Sanhedrin in the Gros Golel. And it was on, and there was his first shiur on giving smicha in Eretz Yisrael. What are the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael? Is it different for smicha than for Yontif Sheni and the kibush? And like there's, when we say Eretz Yisrael, there can be five different applications for different halachot of Eretz Yisrael. So that's what he was, going through. And then I picked up the Sefer and, okay, very good. So, okay. I think, but you are right. When all the rabbis, I don't know that the Rambam Mamish meant all the rabbis. He meant, as you say, most
that's
of the
disputed.
Rabbis.
That's one of the arguments between Marbach and Marbish Chaviv. It's, does it need all or the majority? They have a whole long discussion about that.
Right. Anyways, yeah. Okay. Next week, I believe you're doing on redeeming captives, an unfortunate, practical, you know, question. How far do you go to redeem captives? And I don't have to tell anybody here that, how painful that question is. And, we should hear good news. That's all I can say. Okay. And thank you. And nice to see your mother online, Mrs. Tabori. I think I saw you before. Always a pleasure. Our neighbors from, when Rav Aviyad was a 3-year-old kid, that's when we were neighbors. When the Taboris, of course, were in Toronto, I've mentioned many times, Rav Binyamin, his father, Lava Shalom, was my Rosh Yeshiva in high school at Or Chaim in Toronto on Shlichut, and that's where Aviyad was a little kid. And there was really a wonderful teacher, a wonderful Rosh Yeshiva. And anyways, although I was not such a wonderful student as Mr.
But it worked. You see,
oh, everybody here, if you want to stay online, I'll go off and she'll tell you all the stories she knows about me.
I want to shout out also just for Seth, one of my students here from Toronto. Seth Freeberg is here. Wonderful to see you, Seth.
Okay. Anyways, and this evening, Rabbi Mark Glass, as I mentioned, of Kansas City, will be giving this year tonight on the burden of holy clothes. I think that's the title, the Kohen Gadol, of course, in the clothes. That's tonight. And tomorrow morning, 9:15, my shiur on the Siddur, 11:15, Rabbi Litag, a neighbor of Rabbi Tabori, will be giving the shiur. And Benny Gesundheit, another neighbor, will be giving the shiur at 1 o'clock on Tehillim. We like a lunch food. So, very good. Okay, everybody, be well.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Be well. Thank you very much. Okay, bye bye.